All right, so it is Friday, Free Friday. Tell your friends this is the day you can listen to the podcast for free. A little unusual today. Joe Biden is threatening to make every person in the country wear a mask and so forth, but I'm going to do something else. There's a book out about a very notorious case from 1974. The book is called Operation Jacknap, a true story of kidnapping, ransom, and release. And it's about a guy named Jack Teich, who was along with his brother, was running a manufacturing business. They had a factory and made essentially steel doors. Had quite a few employees. And Jack Teich found himself in the really frightening position that he was on his way home, and he was followed, and he was kidnapped right out of his driveway.
I was coming home about 7 o'clock p.m. in the evening. It was a rainy evening, rainy night. I lived on a peninsula. The only cars that drove down that road were the ones that actually lived there. It wasn't through. There was no through traffic. There was a car right behind me. And I said, boy, this is a little unusual. I looked in the rearview mirror. I said, well, I guess he lives here. Pulled into my street. Lived in a very modest house. Pulled up to the garage door, painted white. And when my headlight shined on the garage door, it was bright, lit up the driveway. So I shut my lights off on the car. There still were bright lights on the garage door. I said, what the heck is that? I fiddled with my lights again. My lights were off. As soon as I got out of the car, there was a fellow on my driver's side as I got out with a long barrel pistol, a ski mask, one on the right side. He got out, ski mask, with a sawed-off shotgun. The driver said, pointed the gun right at my head and said, you're coming with us or we're going to blow your head off. There was a woods behind the house. The woods, I know the woods like the back of my hand. But I said, should I run? And I felt I could have. It was dark. It was raining. I could have ran and said, if I do that, would they go into my house? My wife is in the kitchen with my two kids. So I said, I can't take a chance. They took me over to their car. It was a Ford Mustang. They put me in the back seat, put handcuffs on my hands. They put putty over my eyes, glasses over the putty that they put on my eyes. And I says, what's going to happen now? So they said, look, we're going to rob you and let you go. They started driving away, and I said, well, if you're going to rob me, why don't you just rob me and let me out? Well, they went crazy. I shouldn't be telling them their business, and they're going to do it their way. And we went up to the Bronx. They took me out of the car, walked up a few steps into an apartment. I had my suit from work, my tie, my raincoat on, and they proceeded to empty everything out of my pockets, every one of my pockets. They took everything out, went through everything, and they said, well, they came out and they said, well, we have more in store for you. Pushed me into a closet, which was probably 2 feet by 5 feet, sat me down on the floor. At that moment, I knew this was not a burglary and not a robbery. This was something much more sinister. They had chains on either side of the closet, and the chains went around my neck with a padlock, and the chain went through a loop in the wall. On the other side, chains were around my two legs. They threw a bucket in there to relieve myself. That was the beginning of 7 days of horror.
Now, this, I remember this is 1974. And a lot of stuff transpired after this kidnapping, and I'll get to it, but just to, you know, let you know, there was a trial, there was a guy caught, but it was never really solved. Part of the reason was that Jack had that putty over his eyes, and he never saw really anything after those guys took him. So meanwhile, back at his house, his wife is going, wait a minute, his car is there. But he's not here. What has happened? This is very, very much unlike Jack. Did they immediately contact your family demanding a ransom?
No. What they did was, this was 7 o'clock. That, let's say I was abducted by the time, I don't know, 9 o'clock at night. They waited until 9 o'clock the next night. They waited all day. They let my wife and family torture themselves. Where am I? My car was in the driveway, and I wasn't around, and I was nowhere to be found. I always came home at the same time, relatively, put my kids to bed. They waited until the following night to place the first phone call to my house.
Okay, now, before you go on, I know this is the part of the story that your wife experienced, but you know what happened. She goes around the neighborhood thinking maybe you dropped over to somebody else's house, right?
That's exactly what she did. She went to the neighbors. She felt, well, maybe I did stop off somewhere. She called a couple of friends of mine. Did I see Jack? Did I talk to Jack? Did I meet anybody? No. But my wife was very smart. We had a very close friend that was the an assistant district attorney. And she called him up, and he was friends of the family and knew me since I was a youngster. And she said, look, Jules, Jack, something is wrong. Jack never did this, never came home, and his car's in the driveway. And he said, Janet, just sit tight. He says, I know Jack since he's 4 years old, and this is totally out of character. Let me get back to you. He picked up a phone and called the chief of detectives for the county, and that's when the ball started rolling. They came to the house. They set up tape recorders on the.
They knew it was a kidnapping right away.
No, they didn't know it was a kidnapping, but they suspected big time foul play. They put the tape recorders on, and they captured the first ransom call. The call was, we have your husband. We want $750,000 in unmarked bills, but we're going to kill him. It was a very short call. And we will get back to you with more information.
Which means instructions. Now, remember, this occurred in 1974. Jack was 34 years old, running this business with his brother, had two little kids, 2 years old and 6 year old. His wife is 30. And now she's dealing with this. I mean, the local police in the town, you know, didn't take this seriously at all. They told his wife, well, maybe he's run off with a neighbor. It was, as you just heard, it was the fortunate friendship that they had with the assistant DA that got people to take it seriously. And they got the ransom call. Meanwhile, back at the apartment, they're interrogating Jack. Well, it's one guy, really. There was four people in the room. He could tell there was other people, but one guy in particular was interrogating Jack and lecturing him. You know, this was a guy who had been radicalized, African-American, had been radicalized of the Black Power movement at the time. Was lecturing him about Palestinians and about Israel and about the plight of Black people around the world, and how much money do you have, and where is your money, and what's it invested in? Do you have art? Do you have stock? you have all this is going on back at the apartment where Jack is chained up and essentially blinded or blindfolded. He's got this putty over his eyes and glasses on, and he's being interrogated.
In the meantime, where I was, they were interviewing me and trying to get every piece of information out of me as to finances, the company, the jewelry, any possible thing they could glean from me. They sat and spent hours interviewing me. These fellas were blatantly, they were very, very radical and blatantly anti-Semitic. They were both. And they were the products of that era.
Now, so, when they were, as you put it, interviewing you, would they drag you out of the closet, sit you down, take the putty off your eyes? Could you see them?
No. And they just pushed the doors to one side, and they would just talk to me, sitting when I was sitting in the closet. And
just to be clear, and not to put a racial thing on it, but these were black radicals.
Yes.
And
yes.
Eldridge Cleaver type, Stokely Carmichael. I mean, the characters of that period were, those were the radical leaders of black nationalists.
You know, at the time, this was the, this happened November of 1974. Patty Hearst was July of 1974. And if you recall that era with the Symbionese Liberation Army and the Black Panthers, and there were a dozen of these organizations at the time that was a sign of the times. So there was no question they were caught up in that era.
Now, Jack, your company, this steel fabricating company, was it so big, so notoriously successful that they had a reason to think that your wife could gather up $750,000 very quickly?
The answer is we were a family. We weren't a public company. We were a family-owned business. We had no debt. We were a profitable business. We were not a gigantic, a huge business, but it ultimately turned out that one of them, not the one that spoke to me 90% of the time, but one of the others was an employee of mine for 15 years, worked for the company. He had left 2 years before. So the company did have a profit-sharing plan. The company did have a pension plan, and he was a participant in both those plans. He was also the shop steward of our engineering department. Our engineering department was a unionized department at that time. And I knew him quite well.
You recognized it was him who was...
No, I never recognized. No. He didn't. I was in the dark the entire time. I didn't recognize him. And I'm not even sure he was one of the ones in the room, but there's no question that he fingered me, and there's no question that he had knowledge that he gave the others of the company's pension plan, a profit sharing plan, because they mentioned it to me. They said, "You have these employee plans. Take the money out of those plans." I said, "Well, it's not my money to go take from those plans." So they had knowledge. They had more knowledge than they were letting on of the workings of the company.
You know, I mean, it's interesting. You kind of, those of you who weren't alive then don't remember, but Jack was running this company with his brother. They found two of his paychecks in his pockets, $1,200 in cash, which he had put together because the family was about to go on a vacation. They didn't use credit cards and they paid cash for things. He was being paid, he ran this company, he was being paid $700 a week. And we're talking about $35,000 a year. Not huge money, but these kidnappers imagined that he could put together $750,000 and they were just pestering the hell out of him about where his wife would what she would sell, how she would do it, and how she would get that money. And this went on for, 7 days in this apartment.
You were there in this closet in an apartment in the Bronx 7 days. Just describe that ordeal.
Even today, all these years later, it's hard to think about it. It was harrowing. And by the way, I wasn't in the closet the whole 7 days. It was 4 days in the closet, and then they took me out of the closet, and there was a metal bed next to the closet where they put me into this metal bed and chained me, chained my legs and my arm to the bed. But the reason they did that was then they took pictures that they sent my family, holding up the newspapers, what you see in the movies, to prove that, that I was alive. The rest of the time when they were in with me were just raving and ranting, either anti-Semitism, black power, and then they started with Yasser Arafat at the time, and Palestinians, and all this stuff that was in the newspapers at the time. And they just kept throwing all that stuff at me.
Now, just to remind you, this book is called Operation Jacknap, The True Story of Kidnapping, Extortion, Ransom, and Rescue. Now, so what happens next is the kidnapper, the main kidnapper, instructs Jack's wife, to wear certain clothing, put the $750,000 in a bag, go to Times Square to a phone booth at 8th Avenue and 48th Street, wait for a call, and then when that call came in, she was to go to Penn Station and to another phone booth and another call, and put the money in the bag in a certain locker. Now, the FBI and the police, there were about 400 officers in this area, keeping an eye on all of this, and they wanted to follow whoever picked up the money and see where they went to rescue Jack. It did not go especially well. Jack's brother put the money in the wrong locker.
Lo and behold, my brother puts the money in the wrong box. He was told to put it in a certain level, three high. He puts it in the one above it, and then takes the key and leaves with the key. Doesn't leave the box, the key with the box. So they go to another phone booth, waiting for the call, and the call comes in, and they blasted my brother up, down, and sideways. We're going to kill him. And wife then took over the situation, went back, found the right box, put it into the right box, and then the money was picked up by one person in a trench coat and a hat and a beard, and went into right into a train, got off, went into another train, and they lost him. Now, they said, Jack, we could have grabbed him when he picked the money up. I mean, we were there. We could have grabbed him. We could have grabbed him when he walked on the train. We could have done that, but we wouldn't have gotten you back. We tried. We just couldn't. We weren't able to follow him. With all the people we had there, we weren't able to follow him.
Now, they got the money.
They got the money.
They come back and they say, okay, Jack, see ya. No.
They did come. Well, first of all, you have to understand, I knew nothing about them getting the money. I didn't know the amount. I didn't know any of this stuff.
Tell us how the moment of your release occurred.
One person came into the room and said, we're going to leave now. And you will listen to everything I say, and you won't deviate from anything that I tell you to do, or you're not gonna be around. He took shoe polish, put it all over my face. I could smell it. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, we are gonna be walking outside, walking down the block into the car, and you have to." You have to fit into the neighborhood. So
they put blackface on you?
Yeah, put shoe polish on my face, my forehead, put a hat on me. He walked me outside, sat me down in the car, which was, I'm sure, the same car. Drove for about 45, almost an hour, raving, ranting, lecturing. Drove me to outside of Kennedy Airport, let me out of the car, told me to walk down 10 paces and, you know, all that, don't turn around, all this other stuff. I thought I was ready for a bullet in my head. So I did. I heard the car drive off, took the blindfold off, took my hat off, and tried to get bearings where I was. Don't forget, I hadn't seen the light in 7 days. My eyes, I had to get used to it. Even though it was nighttime, there were still lights around. I noticed the motel. So I walked over to the motel, walked into the lobby. Look, you can imagine what I looked like with a 7 day beard, a shoe polish on my face, and walking in at 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I went over to a payphone, and there was some change in my pocket, called my house. By the time I walked outside, by the time I walked into the parking lot, there were cars all around, police cars, FBI cars. There must have been 10 cars, bing, all around. And that was it.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, okay, Jack, did you go home right away? Oh, no, go to FBI headquarters because they want to catch kidnappers. They want to recover the money, of course. And Jack, meanwhile, you know, in one of those rides with the guy recited the addresses and phone numbers of all his relatives and said if he did anything that led the police to him, that the guy was going to go kill his relatives. So Jack said to the FBI, I'm not telling you anything. You know, my family's in danger from these people. I'm not telling you anything. And they said, okay, look. And they conferred and they said, we will have police protection for all of your family 24/7. And they did it for a year. And during that year, it was pretty much figured out who the kidnappers were. The kidnappers. Who was it?
Well, the one that was caught, his name was Richard Warren Williams. He was a childhood friend, classmate of the Charles Anthony Berkeley, the one that worked for me. By the way, they went to a privileged high school where in New York City, you have to take special testing to get into these schools. These were very smart, very bright people. They actually went into the army together. They were in Korea. Berkeley was a paratrooper in Korea. The other one became a very successful real estate person. He taught college for a while, Richard Williams. He was the one that was caught in California, trying to flee to Mexico. He was caught 2 years after the event, not for 2 years. The trial wasn't until 1978. He was incarcerated for nearly 2 years between the time he was caught to the beginning of the trial. He never gave up anybody else that was involved in the crime although they offered him all sorts of deals. He took a 25 to life sentence, and in New York State, 25 to life means you serve 25 years, and then you can first apply for parole. Never gave up anybody.
Never gave up anybody. Now, he was caught in California living in a trailer park. They found $38,000 stashed in the walls of the trailer. And they figured that he had taken $50,000 in cash to live on and try to escape to Mexico. So $700,000, you know, was still missing. Now, this Charles Berkeley, the guy who had worked for Jack and evidently fingered Jack Teich to Richard Warren Williams, he was indicted as part of the deal. He ran away. He disappeared for 4 years. When he returned, they offered him full immunity. He refused to take it. And then his indictment was overturned on a technicality. So he just kind of beat the whole deal.
So Charlie Berkeley, the one that worked for me, beat the system.
Is he still alive?
Williams, we know, is definitely gone. Berkeley, we're not 100% sure. It's such a common name, Charlie, but we're not 100% sure about him. The other two, we don't know who they are. The plea, there are people they suspect, but they don't have enough evidence. They didn't have enough evidence to go after them. They didn't really have. I mean, I never really saw these. I never actually. This was a big circumstantial case because I never saw them. I couldn't eyeball them and say, "This is the guy that took me." It was a lot of circumstances. My hair was in the car that they found when the police found the car 2 years later. In a junkyard, they brought it back, and forensically, strands of my hair were in that car. I mean, that was the kind. It was a 17-week trial. It was the longest trial in the county's history. 45 witnesses, but a lot of circumstantial evidence.
Again, Williams died.
Williams died. Williams, believe it or not. Because I kept tabs on him, because when he did get out of prison, I sued him in civil court, in federal civil court, and I had him into depositions. I mean, I ran him ragged, and I ended up with a judgment with a $2 million judgment, the federal judgment that I tried to execute. We could not find the money. He was that clever, that smart. So when I wrote this book, I said, you know, the money, 700 of the 750 is still out there somewhere. There are at least two people that were involved that are out there somewhere. There may be siblings. There may be ex-wives of the ones. Williams had a couple ex-wives that know something. I want to offer a reward. So there is a $50,000 reward for information leading to return of some of the money and or information on any of the other people involved. And it's big, bold things in the book.
Okay, so if I can summarize a few things. You're kidnapped. Four people involved. One guy in particular does all the talking. One guy in particular was an ex-employee, gave him all the information to target you. Two others involved in the wind, don't know who they are, where they are. The money, at least $700,000 of it, is still missing, unaccounted for. The main guy is dead. The guy who fingered you is just in the wind, gone someplace. You don't know whether he's dead or alive. and you really never, ever have solved your kidnapping.
Correct. Not completely. And I don't blame the police or the FBI. I think they did a superior job. These were pretty sophisticated, sharp people, and I don't blame them. I don't blame the professionals.
Do you think Williams was the mastermind?
No question. He was the mastermind. He was a really smart guy. When they went back over his history, he taught college without a college degree. I mean, he very successful in real estate, and then he took some bad turns and ended up without money. You know, he did some stupid things along the way. He was a pilot, a private pilot. He owned a plane at one time.
You know, the thing about this book, Operation Jackknap, is it's, you know, got many more to the suspenseful details than I'm able to convey here. I think it's a really fascinating book. And, you know, the thing about this case was it was the largest kidnapping case in America at the time. The ransom was, you know, a huge amount of money. That's about $4 million today. And the other thing to remember is, Jack mentioned it, but when Williams was finally released, Jack sued him in federal court, civil suit, and he and his lawyers deposed Williams. They sat in a room opposite each other, and they deposed him. And, you know, you just have to wonder, and I had to ask, you know, what's it like to sit across the table from the guy who kidnapped you and put you through all of this? You sue Williams, you depose him repeatedly. Were you in the room for the depositions?
Yeah. I spent some real money on this. I had a really good litigating attorney. I had my brother, not my wife. My wife wasn't there. My brother was there in the room. Our accountant and family friend, who was very involved in getting the money together and working with us through this whole thing, he was in the room, and I was in the room, and Williams was in the room.
What was it like to face him?
You know something? When you finally face somebody, but he was about 5'8", gray hair. You know, obviously a blatant liar. I mean, he didn't tell one piece of truth. Spoke in a quiet tone of voice. But they were several hour long depositions, several 2-3 hour, you know, we had him squirming, but he lied. I mean, we didn't get any real facts out of him that could help.
So do you think the money is like in a box buried someplace?
No. What the professionals think is that he got the bulk of the money. He was the mastermind. He carried out the bulk of the work. And the others were the one that were the tag-alongs and the one that fingered me. And they think he had a brother in the Virgin Islands. He had a father in the Virgin Islands. He had four children. They are convinced that he put the money into real estate.
Really?
And in those days, that kind of money was a lot of money. And where... whether it's the United States, whether it's Virgin Islands, whether it's California, whether it's me. I mean, we tried to find it. We searched. We really did. I mean, the police searched on their nickel. I searched on my nickel. And we couldn't come up to it. But they still believe the money, the bulk of it, is out there in some way, shape, or form, not sitting in a box, invested.
Invest in real estate. You just imagine somewhere there's real estate that's was owned by Richard Warren Williams, who's now dead, or his relatives, that was Jack Teich's money. You know, Jack Teich didn't talk about this. One of the other things he told me was that over the years, he just refused to talk about it. He and his wife didn't talk about it with each other. And friends would ask him a question and he'd answer something with a yes or no and just, you know, put out the vibe that he didn't want to talk about it. So this book that he wrote is the first time telling this story. It's, you know, what, 1974, that's 46 years ago. He was 34 years old then. Don't think I'm giving anything away to say he's 80 or close to it now. And it really is a fascinating story that takes you back in a time, you know, I remember quite well. The Symbionese Liberation Army had just kidnapped Patty Hearst a few months before. And, you know, black militant groups were raging across the country. And Jack Teich was caught up in it. And the book is called Operation Jacknap. A true story of kidnapping, extortion, ransom, and rescue. The book is out now. I urge you to get it. It's a fascinating read, and it was great to talk to Jack Teich.